Marilyn Kring Productions in association with Emergent Life Studio presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 2 for Autumn Semester 2019. Lecture 13, delivered on October 1.
Today, interest rates. Before I begin with the topic, we'll do the screens. I will also mention that your midterm exam will be coming up next week on Thursday. On Tuesday, we will be reviewing. That's what Tuesday is for. Now, during the Tuesday lecture, I will tell you what I expect you to know, and then you can either just have the class end there, or you can ask me questions in the class. If you ask me a question, is this going to be on the test, and it's not, I will say no. If you can ask me as many questions as you want for the remainder of the class period on Tuesday, or you can just say, well, I've heard enough, I get to go home early, and you can. It's your call. But the review will be thorough from my end. I will have the exam in front of me, so I'll make sure that I don't leave out a lot. The exam is lecture content. It might be in the book, it might not, but it will be in your lecture. No, I don't lectures. No, I don't give study guides. Your life isn't going to give you a study guide. You were supposed to be taking good notes during this class. Fill in your notes. Get your questions ready for Tuesday, because I will be as forthcoming as I can. One time I had the exam in front of me. Actually, I had it sitting on the scanner, and I didn't realize the scanner was on. Boy, I never had so many students writing so fast in my life. But it is multiple choice, 40 questions. Most are true, and most are multiple choice. There are some true and false in there as well. And again, lectures, what I've said in lecture. If I didn't say it in the lecture, then it's not going to be on the exam. It might be in the book, but there were a lot of things that I've taught you in the class that weren't. There's also those resources in the ReggieNet resources tab, like that PowerPoint and that video, to help you go along too on this. But other than that, come with lots of questions. Now, a quick look at the screens before we get started here. The one number came out today, I believe it was the manufacturing index, that is the worst it has been in 10 years. So that's some place to give you some pause, but the markets are taking a beating, of course. So, sir, is this a really bad day or just a little bit of a bad day? Yeah, this one's a dark day. We're not even to the lunch hour yet, and the bears are having lunch on the bowls. So as you can see, we are beginning. Interestingly enough, I should point out that at the beginning of trading, we were in an up day. Notice the S&P 500. Do you see how at the beginning there was this little bull rally here, and then a couple of bear spikes just it came off a cliff. And it's just been riding a roller coaster down ever since then. So this is a slaughterhouse day, and it might start to recover. It'll probably be quiet through the noon hour. But again, just like we've been seeing before, we're almost to the midday now, and we have maybe 20% of the volume of a full day. So by the end of this day, we probably won't even see half of a normal day's volume on this exchange. That's that everyone, the heavies are just sitting back waiting to see what's going to happen next. And like I said, we did have a serious market that indicator, a leading indicator. It was manufacturing index that sank to a decade low. That is a measure of how much production activity is going on in the country. and it is seriously weakening, and that is the reason for this steep drop-off. Once that number was published this morning, just everything went to hell. And of course, we have the president crying and screaming like a little child that the Fed can do something about this. As I showed you, interest rates are wanting to go the other way, and we can't just keep forcing them down when they want to do something other than that. And that brings us to the subject of today's lecture. You will want to have your calculator with you, either your virtual or your physical calculator, because we are going to do some math today. It's nothing... I should caution you. This is arithmetic for the most part, but there's a formula involved that is pretty easy to make to get wrong or to key in wrong. The one thing that is odd about some of the things we're going to do today is you need to know how many days there are in a year, or how many days there are in a given time period in terms of a percentage of years. Yo. It's interest rates. And also, let me point this out. Interest rates have a lot of different names. Yield. Interest rate, yield, return is another one. They're all just interest rate. But the term interest rate is kind of a generic. Now, interest rate is just one of many different rates you probably have seen in other classes, in other subjects. Growth rate. Decay rate, acceleration rate. There are all kinds of rates out there. They're all just things from physics, numbers that come out of physics. And interest rates aren't any different. But I'm going to show you something real quick here. There are small, simpler calculators that do this very quickly. And let me check something real quick here. Apps. Give me a second here. I'm going to check to see if these TIs can do it too. Nope, that one's not going to do it. This is one thing that is kind of a weakness. Let me check here. Now, I thought maybe this calculator could pull it, but I don't think it can. But I will show you something that does, just very quickly. You have a very simple Windows calculator right here. Oops, I didn't mean to do that. This calculator, you set it into scientific mode, and then you can set it so that it can do conversions. Date calculation. So I can actually find how many days there are between two dates. So in other words, how long is it until Christmas? So I've got it defaults to today's date. And so I'm going to say, okay, to the 25th. That's 2 months, 3 weeks, 4 days. But what we care about is days, 86 days. So get your shopping done now. We have only 86 days until Christmas. And if you include shipping time with Amazon, that's 85.3 days. But this 86 days is what I care about here. Now I'm going to go back 86 days, and I'm going to remember that, back to the scientific. And I'm going to take 86 divided by 365. So in other words, that's 0.2356 years. That's kind of important to know that for some of these calculations I'm going to do in just a little while. But to begin with, interest rates. Madam, give me an example of an interest rate. Say that? No, I'm sorry, I didn't mean it like that. An interest rate that you would be charged. Can you think of one? On a what? What kind of loan? A house, a home loan, a mortgage loan. Okay, there's one interest rate. Sir, can you give me one? Very good. A car loan. That wouldn't be the same interest rate that you pay on that home loan. Another one, madam? Do you have any credit card? Oh, stop looking for help, for God's sake. Do you pay for a credit card? You don't have a credit card? Really? Are you anti-American or something? an interest rate. Can you give me one, sir?
On student loans.
On student loans, yeah. Boy, are you going to be paying for that for the rest of your life. Oh, sorry, that was insensitive. Student loan, home loan, car loan, credit card loan. There are interest rates all over the place, and sometimes there are interest rates that aren't called interest rates. In one interesting example, which I will show you, the Supreme Court of the United States had no one on the, none of the associate justices had the brains to understand that something that was called a fee was actually an interest rate. Hence why they bring in people with law degrees, but they don't necessarily require that they have any understanding of finance or math. But anyway, different interest rates have different values. First of all, an interest rate is nothing but a rental rate. It's a rental rate. It's a rental rate on money or on capital. By the way, another one is the coupon rate on a bond. These are all examples, but they are examples of rental rates. I'm renting money or capital. Now, remember the difference between money and capital. I might ask that possibly on a quiz or a midterm. Hint, hint. Know the difference between money and capital. Okay, so an interest rate is a rental rate on money or capital, but there are many interest rates. So how do we know what's driving the difference between these interest rates? So I'm going to write a nice fat R here. Now, I think the book uses capital R's. Sometimes you'll see different textbooks, different subjects use different letters. It could be a small R, it could be a big R, or you can even see a K for an interest rate. Those are the typical ones you run into in different classes. In finance, in other subjects, management, economics. But I use just a plain old generic little R. Now, breaking it down, there are two giant pieces. There is this thing that is called the risk-free rate, R sub F. Now, this thing has pieces inside it. I'm going to give you those here in a minute. But then there is another one. There is this trio, R sub D plus R sub M plus R sub L. And I'll explain these in a minute. This is called the risk premium. The risk premium. Now, this thing right here, it actually is a theoretical object. We can find something, things that are very close to it. We call them proxies. The most favored proxy for the risk-free rate is a short-term T-bill, a short-term treasury debt instrument, because it's virtually riskless. For all intents and purposes, it is riskless. The U.S., the government is not going to default on a debt obligation. You can buy a T-bill, and you know you'll get your money back. You'll get your investment. they will print more money. If they can't pay you with what they've got, they'll just print more money and give you that money. If the printing presses aren't working, well, we'll just attack a country for false reasons and take all their money and pay it back. Literally, we will do those kinds of things. We could even raise taxes to get you to pay you back. Unfortunately, anymore, that's like toxic territory, saying raise taxes. But the T-bill is pretty much totally riskless. That does not mean it doesn't have volatility, but that volatility is completely removable through diversification. Okay. Inside of this thing are two things. Inside of the risk-free rate are two pieces. The first piece is called the real rate of return, R sub real. It is nothing but the supply and demand dynamics equilibrium. Money has a supply, money has a demand. Where the supply and the demand come together, where the quantity supplied and the quantity demanded are the same, that price is the real interest rate. Now, you probably saw this in your economics class somewhere, money and the real interest rate. In other words, if we have a downward sloping demand curve for money, and usually, I think in economics classes, they still show the short-term money supply as perfectly inelastic. Right there, that's the R sub F at any given time, the equilibrium rate. It's essentially the real rental rate of money based upon supply and demand. So in other words, what the Fed really tries to do, if it wants to expand, if it wants to help the economy, it increases the supply of money from S0 to S1, which means that drives down the risk-free rate from R sub F1 to R sub F2. That's what it's doing. That's all. Applied Econ 101. You're just increasing the supply of something, which drives down its price, or in this case, its rental rate. That's all it's doing. So the constant yelling, lower the interest rates, what that means is that the White House is screaming, put more money, print money, print money, print money. That's all it's doing. And that should bring down interest rates and stimulate the economy. Unfortunately, there's a backlash to this. This is only a short-term effect. As we found out in the late 60s and through the 1970s, you pay a price in the long run. And if you can't stop increasing the money supply to boost the economy, then sooner or later you're going to get the catastrophe of embedded inflation. That's the next one right here. Let me get this one off the board. The risk-free rate has the real rate that is driven by the supply and demand dynamics of money. But it also has this thing right here, which we designate pi with a superscript e. That is expected inflation. Expected inflation. Not actual inflation. Expected inflation. That is where the real problem comes in. Because once the expectation of inflation embeds itself in wages and prices, the Fed could contract the money supply all it wants to absorb that overhang of liquidity, and the markets will not react right away because they'll think the Fed is lying. That's what happened in the 60s and 70s, late 60s and 70s. And I'll tell you that story in summary here in a little bit. Take some decent notes, especially about names and dates. This whole pop fad, names and dates don't matter in history. Yeah, they do. They really do. As I said to you before, history does not repeat itself. It fulfills itself. But anyway, let me give you an example. Sir, you have I've decided that I'm going to hire you as my trusted employee. Now, I'm going to pay you well to work a hard 40 hours a week. I'm going to pay you $100 a week. Yeah. Now, you've worked for me for a year. And so I call you into my office for your annual review, and you come in, and I say, well, you've worked very hard for me, and I'm very appreciative of this. So I'll tell you what. Inflation last year ran at 2%, you know, according to the Consumer Price Index. So I'm going to give you a 2% raise. Now, there's your $2. Trot back to work. Go. Scoot. Okay? Well, you go back to work. And I gave you the CPI went up 2%, so I gave you a raise at the end of the year of 2%. Okay, good. Well, the next year comes, and you come back, and I say, well, you're still doing a great job, and I'm very, very impressed by you. Now, I see that the Consumer Price Index went up by 4%. So I'll tell you what I'm going to do here. I'm going to give you a 4% increase. Yeah, there you go. Now, back to work, chop, chop. Well, the next year comes along, and you come back in. Well, I see that inflation has gone up 6% last year, so I'm going to give you a 6% increase. Now, you come in this fourth year, and I look down at the CPI, and I say, well, I see inflation went up 8%, so, and you stop me. You say, stop right there, fat boy. Why am I cheating you every year? Talk to me.
You're cheating me?
Yeah, you don't see it?
Well, no, because it's like the same, I'm not getting a raise.
Oh, yeah, you are. You're getting a raise. What do you mean? Of course you're getting a damn raise. But there's something wrong with that raise. It actually isn't a raise.
Yeah, it's just like cost of living.
No, never mind that part. There's something even deeper. Financial markets aren't stupid. They would catch this, and I want you folks to see this right now. Do you see that the price increase had already been eaten by, so he's getting 2% after he lost 2%. Then the next year, he got 4% after the inflation had eaten 4% of his purchasing power. Then in the next year, he got 6% after the inflation had eaten 6% of his purchasing power. So when I look down and I see 8% going up, what would you tell me you want for a raise? Come on.
10%.
There you go, Ace. Because this is the expectation of next year's. You've been losing every year. Markets don't like to be taken like that. So when you get a loan, they are not going to put in there the actual inflation rate that's running now. They're going to put in the inflation rate that is expected for the next period. If you take out a five-year loan, I sure as hell am not going to add into that interest rate the inflation rate for the past 5 years. I'm going to add in the inflation rate we expect for the next 5 years. That is a critical part of your life in this capitalist world, is that we don't play with what happened. We play with what is expected to happen. You see, you know, madam, have you noticed that it was a really warm, kind of sunny day, really nice, okay? And it's been pleasant all summer long. Now, so, of course, you should expect tomorrow to be sunny as well. But you peek outside, and you see this ginormous black object coming out of the sky.
And you hear people say, oh, gee, it's an asteroid. Our species is doomed. Well, you say, well, no, we've had all these great days. I will base my expectation for today on what has happened over the past 1,000 years. Is that a good idea? No. You go underground. You dig a hole and you wait for the blast to pass. Then you go up and see if any of the dead bodies have fashionable shoes to wear. Expectation. And it comes to bite us really bad when we ignore the concept. Because once an expectation of any kind gets itself into a system, it's not going to just go away. It's the same process mathematically as what happens on a chessboard. When you walk up to a chessboard, it doesn't matter when you begin the game. All that matters to your next move is where the board is right now. It has no bearing whatsoever how the board got to that position. All that matters is what is there now. That's where your expectation of what will happen with your next move comes. Your expectation of what will happen with your next move cannot be decided on what already occurred on that board through the beginning of the game. That's how chess masters win. That's how computers win. They don't care. They can just wipe out all that information. It's irrelevant. What's relevant is the state, what we call the state of the system at any given point. Okay, enough of that for now. I'm going to take you back to this in just a little bit. However, moving along now, the risk premium has three parts to it. Now, the first one's pretty easy. It's the default premium. It's the chance that the loan, the borrower isn't going to pay part or all of the loan off. The default premium. It reflects the possibility that some or all of the loan will not get paid back. So in other words, a default premium on a credit card would be a big percentage. By the way, in our terminology, we usually use the term basis points. Basis points are 0.01%. So in other words, I would see a lot of basis points on a credit card added to the risk-free rate. On the other hand, for example, a home loan actually wouldn't have a very large default premium, because even if you default, the lender will seize your house, and if the house is less than the value, it's less than the loan value, they will go to the insurance that you were paying for with all of your payments and get the rest of what they are owed. So that is not a very big one. In the between, what would a car loan, would a car loan have a high or a low default premium?
High.
It wouldn't be terribly high because it is asset backed. You see, they'll get a car back. However, one, that car is going to lose a lot of its value as soon as it's pulled off the lot. So right there, they're going to be hurt. So there is some loss expectation. There's also the fact that they're going to have to pay those idiots who repo in the middle of the night wearing those stupid ninja outfits to seize your car and take it away and all that. Not that that's ever happened to me, but happened to a friend of mine who also happened to be a very, very troubled military veteran with firearms. So they let him have his car for a while. It depends. Okay, a student loan actually has a very low default premium because it's guaranteed by the government. And the government will send in black helicopters and wet teams rappelling from those helicopters to come and take your money from you. So student loans don't have a very high default premium. In the middle are consumer loans of different kinds. If they're collateralized, you get a lower interest rate. If they're uncollateralized, you're going to pay a higher interest rate. Now, the next one is a little bit more complicated. The maturity premium. A lender will want more money, a higher interest rate, for the risk of a longer loan. Think about it this way. And I'm going to have to refer to someone who probably has a home here. Do you own a home? Okay, good. I shall use you. Madam, the typical person, homeowner, will flip the house, move on, in about 7 years, in a decent economy, okay? So now, you've taken out a loan from me at 6%. So I expect to get 6% on that loan, my reward, my profit, 6%, for the next 30 years. Well, suddenly, interest rates drop down to 3% on new home loans. What are you going to do?
Refinance.
You're going to refinance. You're going to pay me off. And I'm going to just be furious. What do you mean you're going to pay me off? You give me that money back, interest rates are 3%, so I have to lend at 3%. I was expecting 6%. Okay? So there is a risk that you would refi on me. Okay. So in other words, there's a risk of interest rates dropping and people refinancing, and I was expecting a higher interest rate for many years, and then I have to. Okay, now let's go the other way. Remember that 7 years is a typical time for a home, people to have a home before they pay off that loan and move to a new house. However, you've got a 6% loan with me, and interest rates skyrocket to 12%. Okay. I am so excited because you're going to sell that house and I'm going to get that money back and then I can lend it at 12%. Except that, are you really, really going to sell a house where you've got a 6% loan? No. That's 7 years. I don't care. Your family has grown. You now have 7 children. You have your brother-in-law living in the house, and you have those people that you don't even know living in the basement making things wearing masks. And in the garage, some grunge band is out there doing grindcore all the time. But you don't care. You will stack people on top of each other if necessary, on the roof, in the chimney. Well, the one guy's been in the chimney. He died last year, and no one's been able to get him out of there because he was kind of overweight. He was playing Santa Claus, but anyway, do you see that if interest rates go down or they go up, I'm screwed. I wanted you to pay off that loan in 7 years so I could lend the money out at 12%, but you're not going to do that because you're not stupid. So in other words, it's interest rate volatility, and the longer a loan is, the more the probability that it's going to do something adverse to me, the lender. The longer something takes, the more volatility it has. I'm going to show you an example of that in physics on Thursday, but it's a very typical thing. So in other words, longer-term loans have a higher maturity premium. Shorter-term loans have less of a maturity premium. That's why Treasury bonds have higher yields in normal times than Treasury bills, because there is a maturity premium. It's not a risk, it's just there. And then there is this one called the liquidity premium, or to some illiquidity. I've heard it called the illiquidity premium too. It works like this. If you want to sell a stock or a bond, you can do it online in a matter of a few seconds. When you go to a bank to get a mortgage loan, that bank will have that mortgage loan for no more than a couple of hours before it packages it up with a bunch of them, others, and sells it to a secondary mortgage market. Banks don't do loans anymore. They are just pass-through agents. They give out loans, and then they sell those loans to the brokering market. And then those all the thousands and thousands of loans are wadded up all together, carved into different pieces, and different massive global secondary mortgage markets go ahead and use them. They are also used as a backing for derivatives called collateralized debt obligations, CDOs or CMOs, collateralized mortgage obligations. One way or the other, though, those loans are sold very quickly. They are highly liquid. On the other hand, though, credit cards, if a bank issues a credit card to you, it's probably going to be stuck with that. It couldn't sell it to another person, to another institution. Give you an example. When I ran a penny stock house, low lives of the earth. We dealt in stocks that had anywhere, the prices were anything from $5 on down to 1/16th of a dollar. As I mentioned before, we didn't do pennies back, cents, dollars and cents, we did dollars and fractions. So these were really low-end stocks, barely alive. No one had probably heard of the companies, usually run by dodgy people. Sometimes they weren't. But we'd have someone want to sell. Someone wanted to sell 1,000 shares she had had of this penny stock. She'd had it for like, oh, God, it had to have been from when the company was another company 20, 30 years before. But she wanted to unload the stock. She needed some money. She was desperate for some money, so she wanted to unload this. And so she called me. I was one of the market makers. And so I put it up on the electronic bulletin board service, 1,000 shares sell at market, whatever. And couldn't sell it. There was no matching buy order. It's parked there for days and days. She called all the time. Well, have you sold it yet? This was back before the internet and electronic screens. Have you sold it? No, I haven't got a match. At one point, I finally got a match for 300 shares of it. Another market maker had a buyer, and so we could unload 300. 700 still sat there on that screen day after day after day. You see, her liquidity level was extremely low. That stock just had no liquidity whatsoever. Remember, liquidity is the efficiency with which an asset can be converted into another asset. That should be in your notes. Liquidity is the efficiency with which one asset can be converted into another asset. Liquidity is the efficiency with which one asset can be converted into another asset. There was just no liquidity in this stock. Now, if she had like IBM stock, this was before there was such a thing as Netflix. I think it was even before, it was before Microsoft. No, it wasn't. But I mean, it wasn't one of those where I could just instantly unload it to a buyer. It was just not there. So the same thing would happen if, let's take this. Madam, this fine, upstanding young man from a well-to-do family, doesn't he look like he belongs at some place like Harvard? Look at him. I mean, he does. I mean, it's just, really? Did your parents buy that one? Oh, sorry. You came here where you have to work for your grade from people like me. And I'm proud of you for that. And you are from a good family, but you need $100. So what you want to do is you want to write an IOU to this young woman right here. It's done on fancy parchment paper, wherefore and wherein and who farted and all that kind of stuff. It's really nice on gold filigree. And she's going to charge you an interest rate. Now, she runs into me on a street in Chicago in 20 years. I'm old, homeless, decrepit, and I smell like cheeseburgers. Yeah, I need $100. Woman, get over here. I want $100. Yeah, I got a Kleenex here. I'll write an IOU. I owe you $100. I'm good for it, yeah. Here's your down. Are you going to charge me the same interest rate as him? No, because I'm a higher risk, you see. You see, you could actually sell his piece. It's not just default premium. You could actually sell, if you needed your $100 back before the year was out, you could sell that to someone else. Here, I want to sell this. Now he'll have to pay you. But with me, who's going to buy that napkin, which was rather kind of like I'd had a little cold, or actually it was TB, but, you know. You understand, liquidity is how quickly you can unload an investment. That's purely it. So in terms of loans, one of the driving forces for high credit card loans is the default premium. People default on those right and left. It's also the maturity premium, because if you pay the minimum payment every month, which a lot of people do, that credit card loan is going to last for years and years. You can even calculate it now. And the liquidity is not there, because banks, if they issue credit cards, there's not going to be some other bank that's going to want their credit cards, probably. Credit card loans. The same, by the way, is true of car loans. There really isn't a robust secondary market for car loans like there is for mortgages. These vast, massive pools, they will absorb home mortgages any day of the week in the hundreds of millions of dollars. Those pools are fueled by global financial markets that buy them. You're talking about massive investment companies, giant trust funds, countries like China, Saudi Arabia, Japan, Europeans participate in those markets too. So there is a vast liquidity pool available for that. Anyway, let me go on here. Okay, you put all of those pieces together, and there you have an interest rate. So that's why there are all these different ones. So for example, say you have a 30-year treasury that is going off at, right now, its yield is 4.50%. Now that would mean, if it's a government treasury, it would have the risk-free rate, and the only other thing that it would have in it is a maturity premium. The other ones, there's not going to be a default on a treasury. It's highly liquid. You can sell it within a split second if you need to. So the only thing that would be in that 30-year treasury is a maturity premium. What we can do is, let's say that you have a 30-year AAA corporate bond with a yield of 4.75%. It would have exactly the same structure as the treasury. It would have the same risk-free rate. Everything has that. That's like a substrate. It would have the same maturity premium because there are the same number of years. It would have perfect liquidity too. But it would have a very small default premium. What we can do is we can then find the difference between these, which is 75 basis points. Again, write that in your notes. That's 75 basis points, and that is called the credit risk default premium for AAAs. In other words, we can see how much the market thinks the risk of a default is on the best corporate debt. More importantly, we can watch what that does over time. If we see this number rising, which we are now, that's a signal that the market thinks that the default there's a higher and higher risk of default. As a matter of fact, there are sites, I am pretty sure somewhere in Standard & Poor's Global Net Advantage, they list this. You can do this for anything against the treasuries. Like I could do triple Bs, triple Cs, to see how they are, how much there is. Yeah. I'm just testing you. Yeah, yeah. It's been a very long weekend. Very long. No, I will flunk your ass. Professor's privilege here. Yeah, I tried to take 20% off something that I sold at a show this weekend. And as I look back, I think I took like about 40% off. I was so desperate for a sale. Anyway, moving along here. Let me show you something. I'm going to show you a formula. Put this down in your notes. Somewhere. Put this down in your notes. Because this is absolutely important. This is the general formula for finding a yield. The general formula for finding a yield. And I'm going to do it with an example. You invest $20, or let's say $200, we're not cheap. On September 14th, 2019. On November 29, 2024, you sell that investment for $274. What was your annualized yield? Follow me on the formula. Just push it into the formula and don't make a mistake like I always do. Annualized yield. Here's the formula for it. This is the general formula for an interest rate for a given period of time. It's going to be the 1 plus the ending value minus the beginning value over the beginning value to the 1 over the number of years minus 1. Now, before you write too much, I'm going to simplify this a little bit. Because end over begin minus begin over begin is minus 1. So you can write this more simply, and I did it the other way because I think I've seen this in several books. You can actually just do end over beginning to the 1 over the number of years, minus 1. I showed you the other one because there are books that show it the other way, because there's an even more general formula Here's where parentheses become your enemy if you don't do it right. I need to know the number of years . So in order to do that, the number of years is the number of days over 365. In this case, and this you're going to have to do quickly somewhere as a side calculation and save the number. First things first, the number of days. And for heaven's sakes, I'm going to do a couple of these. You're going to see an example, a real world example of this. And I'm going to do my date calculation here from September 14th to really? I should have known better. I should have gone to Google. Google has a really fast, sweet calculator. Okay, 2024. November of 2024. You know, this is scary because I'm looking at a calendar where I won't be alive. That's really creepy, man. Okay, 29th. 1903 days. So, in this case, it would be 1,903 days over 365. Now, for God's sake, watch it, but here's the way to do it the most accurately. And if you notice, sometimes in those homework problems, you're off by a little bit, and I've tried to fix that, but sometimes even off by a little bit, and it marks a problem wrong. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to say, all right, the ending value, 274 over the beginning value, 200. And I'm going to raise that to the 1903 over 365. Here's where you can make the mistake. You have to trap the parentheses. Watch what I mean. Write these steps down for God's sake. I'm going to take 274 in parentheses, open parentheses, 274 divided by 200. I'm going to close a parenthesis, and now I'm going to raise this to the. Now I'm going to open a first set of parentheses and say 1 over, and now I'm going to open a second set to do that division, 1903 over 365. And then I'm going to close those parentheses, and then I have to close the exponent. You remember that trick I taught you? See if you got it right. Counting the parentheses, 1 up, then 1 down, that's 0. Then 1, 2, 1, 0. Another one that someone actually suggested to me, tell them that there should be two parentheses at the end. One was trapping that denominator, and the other was trapping the whole exponent. This is the only thing, and then I have to do the minus 1. Your return was 6.22%. Again, a caution. If you did 1,903 divided by 365, and then you put that in just as a number, you would have rounding error. And anytime you take an exponent with rounding error in it, it's going to exponentially, as it were, magnify the rounding error. But so there you are. It's a 6.22%. Yeah. You know, I might actually do that. Yeah. Yes, please. Yeah. You know, that's a good suggestion. Yeah. Send me an email, because I forget what you say to me within seconds, you know, until I'm home and I've had something to eat at night. Yeah. That actually, you know, that would be reasonable. Yes. That way you're not making that mistake. And also, I mean, yeah. You know, I know that the scientific Texas Instruments calculators actually can do days between dates. I'm almost sure. Yeah, I know they can. Yeah.
How are we supposed to find the number of days between dates on a test without having...
Well, that's what she just suggested. She said... would you give us the number of days? And I thought about it. Am I really an asshole? And I would give you the number of days. I really would, you know, unless it's something easy. I mean, if I say, you know, between now and tomorrow, that's one day. Don't be expecting me to say that, do that one. But I do want to show you. See, actually, if you can get through the stupid arithmetic, it's actually very simple to calculate returns on investments. And that's something, as a matter of fact, every day I look at my sad portfolio and say, all right, you put the money in here, and now your money is worth this much. Here's your annualized return. And remember, this is an annualized return. It's not a total return. It's your annualized, so you can compare different investments. Like I might have one where I bought it months later and I unloaded it months earlier, and I could compare the two investments and see which one did the best for me. Now, let me show you where this can show up in the real world. I need someone very special for this one. And I think that I can see him right here. Have you ever listened to blues music? Wow. Have you ever listened to country and western music?
Yeah.
Okay, you know those songs about hardships of life, you know? The ones like, you know, I told you I tried to do some country and western songs earlier in my life. Mm-hmm. The one I put my heart on eBay and you didn't bid. The kids are ugly because of you. You know, my mom is a truck stop parking lot angel. She's a good woman, though, damn it. Okay, listen. Okay, we'll say, okay. Now, you have fallen on hard times. Da, 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 da. Your wife has left you. Da, 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 da. Your car broke down on the freeway. Da, 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 da. And you lost your job. Dang. Okay, now, you find out that there's a place called payday loans. Well, you got a job, but you're not going to get a paycheck for a while here. So you need money like now. I mean, you can't live without, you know, food and Jack Daniels and your CBD vapes. So you go to this loan house, and they say, all you have to do is write us a check. You post-date it 2 weeks from today, and how much you need? Well, I kind of like $500. Okay, we're going to lend you $500, and we're going to charge you only 6% interest for those weeks. All you have to do is just, you know, that's, what is that? That's $30. That's all you have to pay us in interest. And just write us a check, post-date it, and, you know, we give you the money now, the $500. And so you, okay. Wait. Before you, we have an application fee. And that's $25. And then you probably want us to cash the check for you. Well, we'll do that for, because I don't think anyone else in town will take these checks. And that is $10. So we are going to have you write your check for $565. And we'll give you $500 now. Well, that's pretty good, I guess. Yeah, that's okay. This is one of these fast loans. This is actually close to a real example of it. Okay, so let's see what the annualized is. Pay in 2 weeks. We cash the check in 2 weeks, okay? Well, 2 weeks would be 2/52 of a year, or 14 divided by 365. You could do it either way. It doesn't matter. Ending value, 565, over the beginning value, 500. Now, to the 1/2/52, or you could do it as 14/365. It doesn't matter. Minus 1. Let's see what your annualized interest rate is on this loan. Shouldn't be that bad. Really? Turns off again? Okay, so you open the parenthesis. 565 divided by 500. Close the parenthesis. Raise it. Now, notice that it's the same pattern. Open parenthesis, 1 divided by open parenthesis, and we'll do 2/52. 2 weeks divided by 52-week year. Close, close. Do you see those two parentheses at the end? I kind of like that one. Minus your 1. Don't forget the minus 1, for heaven's sakes. Oh, 22.99%. Oh, no. That's the decimal. The percent is 100 times that. This is a 2,299.05% annualized rate. Don't let that fool you. That is the annualized rate. When you times it by 100, you get the percent. But the math brings out a decimal version of it. You do notice that is what these lenders are doing. That's why we call them predatory lenders. This is actually still illegal as hell. There are still anti-usury laws on the book. A case of this many years ago went to the Supreme Court of the United States, and they said, no, it's a 6% loan. There's nothing wrong with it. No matter what was tried to show these idiots, these morons there, they couldn't understand that an interest rate is a yield off all of the costs over an annualized time period. They saw 6% and said, there's nothing wrong with this. Instead of seeing the math, they wanted to see simpleton. And that's the problem with making everything simple in life. It sometimes hides absolute outrages. People are doing this by literally the tens of thousands of in numbers every week. Desperate people, poor people, are doing this. You ask them, do you understand? Interestingly enough, what really shocks us is that they do understand. But then there's the answer, what the hell else are we supposed to do? So apparently the people being screwed like this understand that this is, they obviously don't can't calculate the enormity of these interest rates, but they do know they're ridiculous. So there you go. That's the application of this in real life, is you can find out that sometimes what looks like an easy interest rate, once you add in the percentages, this is true with mortgage loans too. Sometimes you'll have mortgage loans that show up with what are called points in them. Those points are like fees, but what they really are is jackups of the interest rate. So when you see points on a loan, that's a big warning bell that the interest rate you will actually pay annualized is something more than what you are seeing on the contract itself as the interest rate. That's all I have for you today. I thank you.